Welcome to the Money Maze podcast. I'm Simon Brewer, and we've created this show to explore and unravel some of the mysteries surrounding the investment business. We hope through direct and insightful interviews with masters of the real-life money maze, we're going to learn about different approaches to allocating capital, making investment and business decisions, and navigating the pitfalls that line the paths to prosperity. Whether you're a current or aspiring investor, entrepreneur, professional, or a student exploring career options, we hope you gain some helpful insights and enjoy the shows. You can keep up to date by visiting moneymazepodcast.com and please sign up to our newsletter, ensuring you won't miss a show release. You can also access more information on the topics covered, related recommendations, partnerships and collaborations that might appeal. You can follow us on all the social media platforms. And if you've enjoyed this episode, please subscribe and leave a review on Apple Podcasts. Thank you for listening. We're delighted to announce our first sponsorship with Bremont, an award-winning British company that produces beautifully engineered chronometers, designed to appeal to those who share the passion and appreciation of the innovation and mastery behind a beautiful mechanical wristwatch. Brought to you by our title partner, the luxury British watchmaker, Bremont. Established over 800 years ago in 1209, Cambridge University is one of the oldest surviving universities in the world and has spawned more Nobel Prizes than any other institution. Cambridge has over 100 libraries, and amongst its extraordinary successes, it was where Fred Sanger invented DNA sequencing. Cambridge itself is now nicknamed as Silicon Fen, since businesses have increasingly strong links with the university, and from bioscience to software, it's one of the agro and high-tech hubs of the country, which seems fitting given that Alan Turing, thought to be the father of computer science and cracker of the Enigma code, studied at King's College, Cambridge. And in memory of one of its greats, Stephen Hawking noted that Cambridge is one of the best universities in the world, especially in my field. And for any sports trivia lovers, the first game of football with association rules was played in Cambridge in 1848. So today we're going to discuss Cambridge University's endowment fund. And my guest today is Tilly Franklin, Chief Investment Officer. Tilly, it's an absolute pleasure to have you here today.
It's a great pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
Well, you may not have won one of those Nobel Prizes yet, but you've had a fascinating and packed career and education. If we start with your education, I think you were first of all educated at Westminster, then Cambridge, then you were a Kennedy Scholar at Harvard and the London Business School, which is a pretty fantastic academic CV. Let's start with what you learned most from your parents that helped you growing up.
I grew up in London. I've always lived in London for the majority of my life. My dad was an accountant, although my father sadly died when I was very young. And my mother was a senior merchandiser with Marks and Spencers. So in those days, a full-time career mom was somewhat unusual. There's an apocryphal story about my dad when I was about six, giving me 10 1p pieces and telling me to open the back pages of the FT and pick 10 companies and then write down in a book what their stocks were worth and keep track of them over time, which I vaguely remember doing. The only stock I actually remember picking is Marks and Spencer's, of course, because my mum worked there. I have no idea what the other ones were. That was my first introduction to investing, which then was taken over by many other interests and then only came back about 20 years later. So I definitely remember my father vividly for that and many other reasons. And for my mum, I also remember having been endlessly dragged around shops and having her sort of turn the merchandise inside out and say why it was or wasn't well made and why it would or wouldn't sell, which was another early exposure to product market fit, I guess. But I think the most important thing that I learned from my parents was just not to take anything for granted. Previous generations of our family had a very different experience, including fleeing from religious persecution, which was what brought them to this country in the first place. And so I'm just very conscious of the good fortune and how that's something that you need to be grateful for every day.
Well, I'm intrigued because when you study at Cambridge and then you go to the US, to somewhere like Harvard, each must play quite a different role. And I wonder what each of those two specific institutions gave you.
They were indeed incredibly different. At Cambridge, I learned to go narrow and deep. I studied English literature, which is quite a different background to any of my peers. At Harvard, I had a much broader experience. My pivot into finance and investing is a lot to do with serendipity, because my original ambition was to be an academic. I originally applied to the Kennedy Scholarship to do my PhD at Harvard in English Literature, but then I didn't get in to Harvard. And fortunately for me, the Kennedy Scholarship still sent me there as something called a special student, which is a year where you can really study whatever you wish to do.
Although we're going to talk about Cambridge in a minute, McKinsey, Virgin, the BBC, Apex and Alta. I mean, that's a pretty interesting selection of employers and also disciplines. How did it come about?
I mentioned this early experience with investing. I was finding my way towards investing without even really knowing. So at McKinsey, I had this grounding in how to analyze businesses. And I then realized that I was more interested in the projects that related to, for example, new product launches or companies looking to maybe execute acquisitions of other companies in their industries. And I was fortunate to follow one of my engagement managers from McKinsey to a job at Virgin, looking at new industries that Virgin might be able to bring its brand to launch new market entrants in, until actually it was during my MBA that I was finally able to put a name to this interest, which was investing.
And I note you were at Apex. We had Sir Ronald Cohen on the show a few months back, who was obviously one of the founders. When you then got into the weeds of private equity, venture capital, I mean, how did your skill set really change?
Well, that was an amazing experience. I worked at Apex for 8 years. I was there for part of the time when Sir Ronald was still leading the business. Apex taught me a lot. So I learned a lot about financial structuring, financial analysis, about negotiations and the art of the deal and which deals were likely to work and which deals weren't. So it was a really wide range of things that I learned there. And particularly from Sir Ronald, I have to say, the importance of reputation. It was very notable that at every investment committee, we would obviously fully discuss the merits and demerits of the individual business and the potential returns and the structure and so on. But he always came back to, you know, how is this going to affect our reputation? And that's something that's incredibly important to me at Cambridge that I remember viscerally from discussions with him back all those years ago.
So your final stop pre-Cambridge is Alta. I know it's a private group. What was the motivation for moving the less obvious choice?
Well, again, serendipity played a huge role in my move to Alta. So I left Apex at the end of 2007 and was actually introduced to Alta by a good friend of mine, Michelle Giddens, who is the founder of Bridges Ventures. And she said she knew this family office and thought they were really great. I was invited to meet them, having absolutely no idea that they didn't do any direct investing. Alta only invested in funds, which was rather embarrassingly something I only found out during the interview. I hit it off with the senior team at Alta and then spent 12 years at Alta and really learned everything I know about endowment investing and more from the CEO of Alta that I worked for the first 7 years of my tenure, Rob Wallace, who now runs the Stanford Endowment. And you know, Alta really was managed and is managed very much along the lines of the large US foundations and endowments. So I had an incredible education exposed to some of the leading endowment thinkers in the world.
So then you take up very recently the CIO role at Cambridge University. Tell us how the endowment has evolved and what it's trying to do.
We have a mission statement which says that the purpose of the endowment is to serve the university, colleges and trusts by delivering world-class sustainable investment performance. We aim to do it at a very high level. Practically speaking, what we are doing is helping to fund the operations of the Central University as well as some of the colleges who've decided to invest with us. And we deliver a distribution to them of inflation plus 4% per year. We aim to generate a return of inflation plus 5% a year. So the overarching idea is that we generate a distribution that helps to fund operations, but then the capital base grows slightly ahead of that. So our investors get gradually increasing source of cash flow over time, over the very long term.
You worry that inflation plus 5% target when the risk-free is zero and assets have been chased up by lots of liquidity might be too much of a stretch?
Well, we do think about that. I was on the investment board of the endowment for 5 years before taking over as CIO. So we do regularly come back to look at the objective and decide whether it's still realistic. Since inception, the endowment portfolio has significantly outperformed its benchmark. So the 10-year return is just over 10% net of all fees. The markets have been favourable. I think the future is obviously very uncertain. So the key thing is to try to create a portfolio that's suitable for all seasons. We need to have enough equity exposure and exposure to risk assets to benefit if the markets continue to rise. We also have to have enough uncorrelated assets that will give us a sort of ballast and allow us to continue to send out the funding that our investors rely upon if market conditions change. So we're not trying to sort of predict what's going to happen in markets, but create a balanced portfolio that really can fulfill its purpose over the very long term.
And how do you think about those big blocks, the allocations of equity, debt if it features at all, and other assets?
The largest allocation in our portfolio, unsurprisingly, is to equities, which we look at across public equity and private equity. Currently in the process of rebalancing that allocation, more in favour of private equity, where the endowment has had a relatively modest allocation in the past, but it's an area where I think it is still possible to generate outperformance. The other major asset class categories that we look at are absolute return, which primarily constitutes market neutral segment of the hedge fund universe. We think about that portfolio as providing a source of relatively uncorrelated returns and potentially a source of liquidity in adverse market conditions that we could use to redeploy to buy risk assets at more attractive prices. And then we also have a real asset portfolio, which is primarily invested in UK real estate, but where we're also looking at adding other real asset categories, including renewable energy, potentially also forestry and agricultural land.
I suppose it's not a new observation or concern, but the vast amounts of liquidity sloshing around in the PE world and increasingly transactions being between PE firms. How do you think about that?
A lot of people are concerned about the increased competition levels that has become vastly more competitive. I started out in private equity in 2000, but I do still think it's possible to outperform in private equity if you have a very distinctive strategy, bring a particular insight to a market segment. You can still acquire assets at reasonable prices. Critically, equity firms have the additional lever of their governance influence over their assets, which is very different from being a public equity investor.
And do you split your team between members who look just at private versus public, or how do you think about specializations?
We've had the interesting experience of rebuilding the investment team altogether over the last 12 months because the previous investment team had left the endowment. I should note the challenges of bringing a new team together under remote working. So with the current investment team, only two of us actually had joined before we all transitioned to remote working. And although we have all been able to meet each other at one point or another during the past year, not all the members of the endowment team have actually met each other at this stage because we do have dual locations in London and Cambridge. In terms of the way the team is structured, we broadly split the portfolio between the sort of liquid assets and illiquid assets, and have senior team members specialise on each of those categories. And then our junior analyst team are completely generalist, so it's very important for us that they get a very broad experience across all asset classes. So they all sort of work more on a project basis, depending on what the broader team's priorities are. And we also have a dedicated sustainable investment officer who's been very instrumental in defining our sustainability approach across the whole portfolio as well, who's a key member of the team.
I'm going to come back to that issue in a minute, but I guess just to help me get this right, how big is the endowment and how many people are dedicated to the team?
Sure. So the endowment is around £3.5 billion altogether at the moment. And we have an overall team of 16 people. So 9 are primarily focused on the investment side and 7 on the operations and administration side.
And the fund has distributed close to £1 billion over the last decade, I think I'm right in saying, which is an extraordinary amount. Just tell me a little bit about how that works and the beneficiaries.
the endowment's distributed around £900 million since inception. The endowment was brought in-house in 2007. So before that, it was significantly smaller. It was less than £1 billion in size, and it was managed externally. We, every quarter, distribute the, there's a mechanical formula that calculates the amount that's to be distributed based on this objective of inflation plus 4%. We then distribute that to our underlying investors, the largest of which is the Central University, but we also have 13 of the Cambridge colleges that have elected to invest with us. We also have a number of charitable trusts that are specific to Cambridge. So, for example, the Gates Trust, which funds graduate education at Cambridge, invests with us as well.
At the Money Maze podcast, we're proud to have a lot of influential gatekeepers of capital. So I guess the question is, would you, like Oxford, accept outside capital?
Well, we see ourselves very much as a service provider to the university. We don't see ourselves as a commercial business entity in our own right. So we don't have any plans to accept external capital in the foreseeable future. We do, of course, hope that over time, more of the colleges will choose to invest their endowment capital with us, although, of course, that's entirely up to them.
We've seen this phenomenon elsewhere, but why do you think there is a reluctance from some parts of Cambridge to join forces, given the expertise that surrounds you?
I think you'd have to ask each individual college that question. Many of the colleges, all the colleges, in fact, are fiercely independent. And what has struck me is that everyone is very idiosyncratic. So I think it's difficult to generalize in response to that comment.
I want to come back to this idea of real assets, because if we are moving into a world where there is more inflation, the real asset component arguably is going to become more valuable than ever before. How do you think about real assets? They mean slightly different things to different people, from water to real estate, which you mentioned, to gold. And there's even a question, I suppose, about cryptocurrencies. I wouldn't put that in a real asset category, but how do you think about breaking that down?
The largest bucket within our real asset portfolio at the moment is real estate, which is a combination of directly owned real estate and real estate that we access through a small number of dedicated real estate funds. Real assets are any sort of hard assets that you can sort of touch and feel. We are particularly interested at the moment in renewable energy assets, also in potentially in timberland, given the uncorrelated nature of the returns that can be generated, as well as the potential environmental benefits of investing in timber.
Yes, we had Tony Dorward, who's the chief executive of Gresham House, on the show, and I think they are now the largest commercial forestry owner, and I think the 20-year returns are 10% per annum of forestry, so many of us have wondered why we haven't had any forests in our portfolio. Thinking about this abnormal world, certainly in terms of the cost of capital, being in this zero interest rate environment, it makes allocations to bonds essentially impractical, given the endowment's aim of preserving and growing in real terms. What other alternatives and different asset classes do you think fit with the endowment's approach and that you might consider?
Well, Simon, you're right that the traditional 70% equity, 30% fixed income portfolio is very problematic these days. And historically, I think many endowments had very low allocations to fixed income and sovereign fixed income in particular, which in hindsight didn't serve the sector very well, because looking back, of course, treasury bills have outperformed even many categories of equities over the past 20 years due to the extraordinary central bank actions that we've seen. So what do we do now with interest rates at rock bottom levels? We're looking at a number of things. I mean, it is very important for the endowment to have a source of less correlated returns over time and a source of potential liquidity to deploy into future market corrections. So one area that we're very interested in is different categories of arbitrage strategies. So looking for securities with very similar sort of underlying collateral, but that may trade very differently, often because one of them is in an index, for example, and the other isn't, and then looking to exploit those pricing differentials. So we're looking at strategies of that nature in a number of different areas. And then maybe on the completely other end of the spectrum, moving away from the technical to the physical, we're certainly not alone in this, but we are very interested in renewable power generation, just because you do have very long-term predictable offtake contracts, which are also inflation-linked in many cases. So that's sort of the other end of the spectrum with a similar goal in mind.
Let me come back to this idea of sustainability. You pointed out you have a new environmental social governance officer. I suppose to the cynic, it sounds a bit like the Soviet political officers who accompanied the submarine captains to make sure that they didn't abscond. But it was Edmund Burke who said that radicalism is driven by ideologues and seeks to impose a dogmatic vision of life upon society. And on the one hand, we've got an endowment with long-term aims, very clear inflation objectives, but the students can be extremely vocal, but they are in transition. And those are two competing, slightly polarized forces. And I wonder how you think about reconciling them.
Well, when I took on this role, I knew that there had been an extensive debate going on for some time about the endowment's kind of environmental profile and whether or not the endowment should divest, for example, from its fossil fuel holdings. My approach was really to spend a lot of time talking to my stakeholders. We have a very diverse group of stakeholders, including past students, current academic staff members, non-academic staff members, and we also think about our duties to kind of future generations of students as well. I actually concluded that the dichotomy that's often represented between one group of people who primarily care about environmental sustainability, shall we say, and another separate group who primarily care about financial returns or perhaps financial sustainability, that schism or dichotomy is actually a false one. And the factor that reconciles the equation, as it were, is really the length of time horizon that one takes. Because if you genuinely are a long-term investor, and Cambridge has been around for over 800 years, we think about trying to preserve these assets in perpetuity and grow them as well. It doesn't make sense to invest in any businesses that are unsustainable. We are in the middle of an energy transition. The science is really irrefutable. Cambridge is one of the world's leading scientific universities, and indeed we have an academic centre, Cambridge Zero, that's dedicated to the study of future net zero economy. And so to my mind, it made sense for us to actually focus on categories of underlying investments that are genuinely sustainable over the long term, because that makes financial sense as well as sense from a more moral standpoint, I guess.
Thank you, because it's not always answered as well as that. You are involved in that, I suppose, ecosphere of Cambridge, which is, as you rightly pointed out, staffed with brilliant minds, all sorts of disciplines. And I'm just intrigued, how do you take advantage of that? How does that cross-fertilization work?
Well, unfortunately, we haven't really been able to go to Cambridge very much. And even if we did, most people are sort of working remotely. I am very fortunate to have a number of colleagues within the university who made some great introductions for me and for my team. And so one of the really critical ones has been to Emily Shuckburgh, who's the director of Cambridge Zero. And she was really an incredibly helpful thought partner to me as we were working through our approach to sustainability in the portfolio. We also are striking up a collaboration with the Cambridge Institute for Sustainability Leadership, or CISL, which is one of the world's leading centres on sort of rewiring the economy for a sustainable future. One thing that we're working on with CISL at the moment is we're actually developing an executive education programme, a very short but very targeted programme that's specifically targeted towards fund managers, which focuses on how investors can actually be better stewards of the underlying businesses that they own from a sustainability standpoint. And we'll be offering that program to the fund managers in our portfolio, of course, on a voluntary basis.
So Tilly, the active versus passive debate rages. You have lots of people who would love to work with Cambridge from an investment perspective. How do you think about the active versus passive debate?
Still big believers in the benefits of active management. It's very hard to find managers that sustainably outperform. We're fortunate in a way that we're at a size where we can still get great benefits from working with managers that can be quite niche, quite boutique in terms of their focus. I think it would be much more difficult to consistently access outperforming funds at a much, much greater scale than our own. We'd still look for active management wherever we can find groups that we really think have a differentiated insight or sustainable edge. The vast majority of our managers have delivered significant outperformance during their tenure with us, which is no credit to me, having obviously only joined relatively recently at this point.
And at the board level, where you have sat for a while, you have the benefit of drawing upon all sorts of brilliant people, alumni and others. And I think it was Peter Harrison when he was on the show talked about his view you really wanted to get neurodiversity on a board. How's the board put together? And tell me a little bit about how you think about that.
I'm very fortunate to work with a really wonderful investment board and the chairmanship of Peter Redman. We'd like to have to be able to access expertise from each of the major asset classes that we target, looking for cognitive diversity, different approaches. And we also have had a number of new board members. I'm really excited about the opportunity to work with this group. And I think actually also in our executive team, we've been very focused on that as well, putting together a new team. It was a delicate balance because on the one hand, you want to make sure that everybody gels and has a core set of underlying values that they share. But at the same time, you desperately want to avoid groupthink. So how do you get that balance right? That's something that I was very, very focused on at the beginning of last year.
And what is it about Cambridge and the opportunity that you've taken on here that you enjoy most?
I think the most important thing about the role is, of course, doing all these things that I really enjoy in service of Cambridge, which is an institution that's given me so many great opportunities and that I feel so passionately about. I think I've been extremely fortunate as well to recruit in a really outstanding team where we do have very different perspectives on things, but we all fundamentally sort of believe in the same high-level investment philosophy.
So let's switch tack away from Cambridge. I believe you established this charity GAIN, Girls Are Investors GAIN. Tell me a little bit about how that came about and the mission.
Well, I'm really excited about the future for GAIN. The way it came about, once again, was somewhat serendipitous. So I had the huge opportunity of participating in an executive education program called the Finance Leaders Fellowship at Aspen. So the Aspen Institute runs a number of fellowships for leaders in a wide variety of fields, and they had recently established one specifically for the finance industry. This program is about a week every 8 months or so where you'll get together and talk about how you can really step up and have a bigger impact in your career. So the homework project from this program was to establish a nonprofit initiative for the benefit of the finance industry or to make the finance industry better. And I have to say, it's been by far the kind of hardest homework I've ever had to do. But the idea for GAIN came out of that originally about 3.5 years ago. A number of my peers in the industry who were also excited about the opportunity to essentially inform and inspire more young women to consider investment careers.
Well, I suppose it begs the question, why do you think not enough of the female population think about investing as a career?
So I think you've hit on a really, really fundamental question. And it's always notable to me how many senior women in investment management actually, when asked, say that they fell into the industry or got into the industry by chance. And if you actually look at the application rate, so if you're looking at, for example, entry-level roles in investment management, and I've looked at this anecdotally, I've also looked at survey data from the recruitment industry, only 20% of applications to entry-level roles are from women. So the industry tends to recruit approximately in line with that application rate. So talking at the industry level, because of course there are exceptions to this, people who have many more or fewer women, you have about 20% of the entry-level pool is women. Some of them drop out along the way. And then by the time you get to sort of partner or decision maker level, fewer than 10% of the remaining population is women. So this is a sort of mathematical fact. My thesis is, and the thesis that GAIN seeks to address is, until we actually have more women coming into the industry at an entry level, we're not going to be able to address the gender imbalance that we currently see. Why are these young women not applying? Essentially, they just count themselves out from a very young age. They don't know what investing is all about. It sounds like it might be very technical. There's a kind of assumption that it's not for me. And there are also very few role models available to these young women. They're just never considering becoming an investor in the first place. So that's what GAIN seeks to address by our two programs. We have the school program and universities program. So in the school program, we send our female colleagues in investment management into sixth forms to give a very simple and compelling talk about what a fascinating and rewarding career investment can be, to sort of address both the role model gap and the information gap. And then at universities, we have a series of online panel and educational events that helps young women to get up the information curve once they've established that this could be something of interest to them.
So it's less of their being concerned that there's a glass ceiling, but more just that it's a sense that it's an alien continent.
It's just there's no information and there are no role models available to them, by contrast to many other career options that just perhaps seem easy to access. So we're trying to fix that, but it's very, very grassroots. Of course, at the moment, we can't go into schools because schools are closed. So that's making it harder. But I'm really encouraged when you go in to give these talks at sixth form level, and there are always a number of people who are really engaged, who sit up, who ask really, really good questions. It's also about drawing the connection back between investing and the real economy. So helping people to understand that this isn't some kind of esoteric thing that kind of goes on in the vacuum. Of course, there are some very esoteric aspects to investing, but investing also drives real world benefits. It drives economic growth, creation, new product development, story of Apple. And almost everybody's either got an iPhone or another smartphone. So it was sort of trying to bring it back to things that the audience can really understand and relate it to their own experience. And then that really helps to generate interest and enthusiasm.
Yeah, well, we've been very lucky on the podcast because we've had a range of really successful female investors and investment managers, Helen Watson, Dr. Christina McGuire, Audrey Choi. They've got all had really interesting and very different stories. And in fact, their podcasts are available and they're free and they're on our website. And so in terms of getting the message out, each of them has had fascinating stories. So good luck with that, because that's very exciting and very necessary. Would there be any advice you would give to a 20-year-old Tilly Franklin?
Yes, definitely. I would say, hindsight's always perfect, isn't it? But I would say to myself, it's okay to not know what you want to do with your career. I think that few people do know what they want. Do what interests you. Do what you're passionate about. And if something isn't working out, don't be afraid to make a change and try to find something that suits you better.
So if you could have lunch in Cambridge with two Cambridge alumni, who would they be?
One person that I would love to have lunch with, although I'm sure this isn't a very original choice, is Alan Turing. I spend a lot of time looking at developments in technology as part of my work, and he must be one of the greatest innovators of modern history in terms of just the extent of change that's come about in all of our lives as a result of some of the ideas that he had. So I'd love to ask him what thought process led up to those innovations. And then I think it would also be amazing to ask him what he thinks of how computing has developed and some of the maybe more philosophical and ethical challenges that are posed by the development of artificial intelligence in particular. And then the other person is actually my brother, John Franklin, who sadly died when I was in my early 30s. And my half-brother was much older than me, more than 30 years older. We didn't grow up together. And as a result of the age difference, we were never as close as I now wish we had been. And I think it would be amazing to be able to meet up and speak to one another as two peers. I think he would also love to find out what I'm doing. And I think he would also enjoy meeting Alan Turing.
Great. Well, that's a lovely idea. Thank you. And I understand you have two daughters, as do I. And I guess what do you find is the biggest challenge in this environment, raising two daughters?
Well, at the moment, it's obviously the COVID restrictions, and I'm sure you're finding, I mean, it's not healthy for teenagers to be studying online in their rooms all day on screens, or they spend enough time on screens as it is without having to be doing school on the screen all day long. So I think that was really overridden all the normal concerns that one might have. So we're all just desperate for them to be able to get back to school, get out and about. Although I personally relish being able to spend more time with my children, I'm not sure that feeling is entirely reciprocated. So it will be great for them to be able to get back out and spend more time with their friends and doing the activities that they enjoy.
And when we are unlocked and freedom is in front of us, where do you most want to go?
I really just want to go back to the office. It sounds really sad. I really miss being with my colleagues. at one point people were talking about having increased flexibility and working from home bringing certain benefits, but just that sort of day-to-day interaction, the chance to catch up informally as well as formally, I really, really miss that. So rather a prosaic ambition, but yeah, just take me back to the office.
Who would have thought? Just a few final questions. We are bombarded with investment information in what we do. How do you deal with that overload?
That is a good question. And I think one of the really brilliant things about this job is having access to our fund managers. I get to read the investment letters or, you know, investment reports of some of the leading investors in the various asset classes and geographies that we target, and have the chance to interact with those people. I'm already getting a sort of filter in a way from that perspective. Then from my colleagues, we all kind of pick out certain things that we enjoy reading about and circulate them. But I, you know, I'm still also just always reading, listening to your podcast, for example, listening to other podcasts, and we just generally picking through things. I think also reading things outside investing is really important. I mean, we were talking about cognitive diversity earlier on, and one of the most interesting books I read last year was Rebel Ideas, which focuses on cognitive diversity. And, you know, I actually really try very hard to read around a lot outside investment fiction and nonfiction, and not always, but very often, interesting analogues and ideas pop out of that as well.
Well, thank you for listening to our podcast. We're quite excited because we've just gone through 100 countries in which the Money Maze podcast has been listened. And I'm sure one or two may decide they must visit Cambridge after this. If you are a visitor to Cambridge for the first time, what are the two or three things you should absolutely do or see?
Punting on the Cam is a must do, probably the iconic Cambridge experience. I also would highly recommend Evensong at King's College, which is open to the public, which is just incredibly beautiful musical and architectural experience. And then my college, Jesus College, is perhaps one of the slightly less well-known colleges. It's slightly outside the centre of Cambridge, although it's only about a four-minute walk. Cambridge is very concentrated, but the Jesus College Chapel is, I think, actually the oldest building in Cambridge that's still in use by the university. It's very, very different from King's. It's much smaller, it's much older, but I think that's one of the less well-known sites that I really love. And I, whenever I go up to college, I always go and sit in the chapel for a moment of contemplation.
So Tilly, you said about the wish to return to work. I note that Stephen Hawking said work gives you meaning and purpose and life is empty without it. So you see there are clearly great minds working in unison. Tilly, it's been a really, really enjoyable conversation, and I'm going to take away a couple of things. One is that I have not been to Evensong at King's College, and that sounds just like a lovely thing to do. So that's on my list for later this year. And for girls listening to this show, Gain, your charity, which is opening up and exploring the opportunity for working in investment and all the reasons why it's a great career and a very exciting business to be in, I think should be something that people look at and follow up with. So with that, thank you, Tilly. Good luck with your very demanding job you're going to have at Cambridge University, but they sound like they're well armed with you, and we look forward to talking again.
Thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you for listening to the Money Maze podcast. For more information or to subscribe, please visit themoneymazepodcast.com. Hope to see you next time. All content on the Money Maze podcast is for your general information and use only, and is not intended to address your particular requirements. In particular, the content does not constitute any form of advice, recommendation, representation, endorsement, or arrangement, and is not intended to be relied upon by users in making any specific investment or other decisions. Guests and presenters may have positions in any of the investments discussed.